This was recorded in Melbourne on the 17th of February 2009 for Radio TC International. This is a recording about sociotherapy that was developed in Fraser House, a therapeutic community, in fact, Australia's first therapeutic community, that was founded in 1959 by psychiatrist, sociologist, Dr. Neville Yeomans. And in this recording, I'll be looking at the nature of the sociotherapy that was evolved there and the how of the change work. Neville Yeomans was both a sociologist and a social epidemiologist who was pioneering sociotherapy, clinical sociology, applied sociology, organic public sociology, as it's come to be called, and social epidemiology praxis in the 50s and 60s in Australia. Yeomans' role during this unique period is outlined in this recording, including his founding of Fraser House that has been discussed in previous recordings. This will particularly look at the way in which the social networks of residents were changed through social practice. The material that I'll be presenting today comes out of research that I carried out that was based on triangulating data from archive research, action research, along with Neville while he was alive, he died back in 2000, as well as prolonged interviews with Neville himself and others associated with him in the 1950s and 60s. The anthropologist Margaret Mead, she visited Fraser House in the early 60s, describing it as the most advanced therapeutic community she had visited anywhere in the world. In fact, Margaret Mead was particularly impressed with the totality of the way Fraser House processes were simultaneously interconnecting, interdependent, interlinking, interacting, interrelating, interweaving. Like everything was totally and utterly woven together to contribute to social transformation. And the UK therapeutic community pioneer Maxwell Jones, in writing in the Fraser House book of Yeomans and Clark, said, given such a carefully worked out structure, evolution is an inevitable consequence. And he was talking about for staff, patients, outpatients and visitors alike. So perhaps we could go on to now what was the essence of this work that was going on back there, this clinical, what I'm calling clinical sociology. Now at Fraser House, the focus of change was the person and their social network. Although Yeomans was trained in psychiatry, his principal mode of engagement, I would characterise as clinical sociology. The application of a critical and reflexive sociological perspective to an action research-based action and the analysis of the intervention for positive change. That's quoting a definition, in fact, by Clark and Fritz in 1989. Yeomans' clinical sociology practices involve this evolving of sociotherapy. Clinical sociology was not common in Australia at the time, and Yeomans pioneered the Australian praxis. The clinical sociology action research was itself researched using applied sociology. Neville was setting up continually all manner of applied sociology research into this ongoing action research. He had both internal and external research teams that were very busy, in fact, involving the patients and outpatients as researchers. Utilising sociological theory, methods and skills, collect and analyse data and to communicate findings back to staff, patients and outpatients in order to enrich the very praxis. In fact, considerable training was given to the patients and outpatients in sociology research methodology. Findings were also passed on to other social scientists. When the unit was opened in September 59, neither Yeomans nor the staff, nor perhaps anyone else in Australia, had any experience in clinical sociology running a therapeutic community. Clark and Yeomans outlined their clinical sociology practices in their books, and I'll quote from them on page 198. The treatment is sociologically oriented, they write. In this setting, patients become active in their own treatment and come to care about and take responsibility for each other's welfare. More specifically, treatment is based on the belief that the social network in which the patient is enmeshed both generates psychopathology and may be used to reverse it. End of quote. Clark and Yeomans characterise the patients' and outpatients' behaviours as symptomatic of discordant social networks. And I quote again, its characteristics must be changed before the person can resolve his conflict constructively and behave normally. That was the end of that first quote. The characteristics was the characteristics of their social network. And then I quote again, in the final analysis, all efforts of members of the therapeutic community must be directed towards reducing unresolvable contradictions. This is sociotherapy, as distinct from individual psychotherapy and group therapy. It depends on an analysis of the characteristic of the patient's complete social network and of how his personality is revealed, or his or her personality is revealed in his or her actions in this context. This is socioanalysis, as distinct from psychoanalysis or individual psychotherapy. End of quote. So Yeomans and the others, in fact all involved, were evolving contexts conducive to immersion in an emergence of altruism and what Sorokin has termed amitology, amitology, the applied science or art of developing friendship, mutual aid and love in individual and intergroup relations. Sorokin wrote about that in 1954. Also, Wernstein, 2008, is another reference. Wernstein, W-E-R-N-S-T-E-I-N. Yeomans formed Fraser House as a social space where people cooperated together in mutual help to reconstitute themselves as they constituted the Fraser House community. And in that process, reconstituted and massively expanded their social network towards functionality. Now, an integral aspect of Fraser House was that Neville, as clinical sociologist, as well as all the staff, had a patient enabler role, where enabling involved supporting patients to be able to live functional lives through being immersed in their own self-help and mutual help. Patients and outpatients also become highly effective in the enabler role, supporting each other as well as supporting ex-patients and ex-outpatients towards functional living. Yeomans spoke of controlling intake so the unit became a balanced community. He endeavoured to have within Fraser House equal numbers in each of a number of categories consistent with evolving a complex, though balanced, though diverse, social system. Fraser House patients were transferred to the unit in equal numbers from, firstly, the mental hospital back wards, where the system had essentially given up on ever changing them and was what could be called warehousing them. And secondly, residents came from prisons where those selected for Fraser House typically would not be given a day of parole in the prison system. Fraser House patients were typically in the worst case category. Yeomans expressly chose to receive these worst-case scenario individuals as he wanted to evolve and document clinical sociotherapy processes proving to be effective in mobilising the innate potential of individuals subject to extreme states of mental illness and social disintegration to co-create sustainable integrated wellness outcomes together. As well as balancing these marginalising backgrounds, Yeomans sought and maintained balance within the unit population on the following characteristics: inpatients and outpatients, males and females, married and single, young and old, underactive and overactive, underanxious and overanxious, undercontrolled and overcontrolled. So on all of those things, they were taking a balanced intake. One use of social process was to have each of the four-bed dorms allocated to two people who were, for example, underactive and over-controlled, and two people who were overactive and under-controlled. And Neville used to talk about having opposites sharing the same dorm as being based on the principle that the presence of opposites supports the self-generation of new normal positions in the middle. Yeomans reported that Fraser House research showed there was a tendency towards the mean, with the under-control becoming more self-regulated and less hyperactive, and the over-control becoming less hyper-regulated and more flexible and active. Now, prior to attending Fraser House, a patient's network typically was dysfunctional and had less than six members. There was a requirement at Fraser House that, as a condition of being a resident of the unit, prospective patients had to first attend the unit's big and small groups 12 times, along with their family friend network members, and all of them signing in as outpatients. This requirement had the effect of having people thoroughly absorbed into the Fraser House community before becoming residents or outpatients, and with all of the advantages flowing from this prolonged induction process. Now, the following section briefly outlines some of the processes that were involved within Fraser House to transform dysfunctional patients and outpatients to functional living and being effective social change agents in their own lives. Every aspect of the unit was linked into every other aspect of the unit in multiple ways, so that everything was densely interwoven. Recall that this is what Margaret Mead was so impressed with. Within the unit, the underlying caring values, focus and expectation was towards change in patients and outpatients, enabling functional return to everyday society at the end of their stay in the unit. The focus was on constituting biopsychosocial resources, well-being, resilience and capacity to thrive even in adversity. The length of stay was reduced from 6 months to 12 weeks. This was after 2.5 years of operation, in fact. After leaving Fraser House for the first time in a period in wider society, patients could return to stay at the unit for 12 weeks for up to three further times by arrangement. All staff on duty, as well as patients and outpatients and visitors, attended big group, and this was typically a group of around 180 people, and it was held morning and evening on weekdays. All of these people would be crowded into a rather small room as shoulder-to-shoulder audience and crowd to each other's change work. And the group, big group, was based upon vicarious conditioning, experiential learning, sociotherapy and other processes. Now, Neville Yeomans was particularly interested in big group therapy, social processes for crowd synchrony and contagion, and how to use these and other social forces for enabling nurturing, caring and well-being for the common good of all present. Crowd and audience effects, as well as crowd, audience and group processes, were being continually explored and utilised in big group for change towards functionality. After each 1 hour big group and a half hour break, there were small groups for 1 hour. Another aspect enriching sociotherapy was the way membership of small groups was structured. All of the people attending big group were divided into small groups based upon a set of sociological categories. These entailed things like age, sex, married, single status, locality of where they came from, kinship, social order, such as manual, clerical or semi-professional or professional. And one group was age and sex, that enabled them to look at intergenerational issues. And these categories, as a basis for dividing people up into small groups, were rotated each time small groups were held. This meant that there was a continual functional, Neville spoke of functional cleavering of dysfunctional groups, so that they could together explore and separately explore aspects of their behaviour, and being in the world before being reunited in the next big group. Unless otherwise arranged, outpatients left the unit immediately after the small groups. Initially, Yeomans was the leader of big group. Later, others took on this role, including Brian Hennessy. Now, he was the one who came as the psychiatrist when Neville went on his holiday after about 2 years. Warwick Bruin was another one. He was the unit psychologist that I've interviewed. Phil Chilmaid was another one who ran big group. He was a senior charge nurse. And I interviewed him along with Margaret Cockett, who was the anthropologist, psychologist and personal assistant to Yeomans at Fraser House. I was able to interview her as well. Bruin reported that some patients also ran big group. I spoke to him in March 2008, where he reconfirmed that again. Yeomans developed the big group leader role, which in part entailed continually scanning everyone, including the various factions that were in the group, the isolates, and Neville was sensing the themes that were emerging, the mood, the patient group values, as well as the leader role in the interaction. Now, in the following half-hour break between big group and small groups, the staff, together with Neville, reviewed these four aspects of the leader role to increase the staff's awareness and appreciation of what Neville himself was doing and the nuances of the leader role. Towards them taking on this role themselves in the small groups and potentially in big group. In fact, Warwick Bruin, when I spoke to him in March 2008, he was only, I think from memory, about 23 or 24, and he said it was totally daunting the first time he took a leader role. At any moment, anyone present could become the focus of the crowd's attention, and this galvanised everyone's involvement. Warwick, when I was speaking with him, described big group as totally exhausting, though totally compelling for everyone that was there. So during that half-hour break, these four aspects were reviewed by Neville and all of their staff that were present to increase the staff's awareness and appreciation, as I was saying, of the just exactly what was the dynamic that was going on. See, Neville himself was using those four frameworks in order to keep track of what was happening in the group. Repeat them again, the themes, the mood, the patient group values, and what his role was in the leader interaction. Now, during big group and small groups, Yeomans was constantly drawing the attention of everyone present to functional social aspects of the moment-to-moment role-specific behaviours in context of attendees who are the focus of group attention. Now, this is significant, so I'll repeat that again. Yeomans was constantly drawing the attention of everyone present to functional social aspects of the moment-to-moment role-specific behaviours in context of attendees who were the focus of the group's attention from time to time. In talking about drawing attention to micro-experience, Yeomans used the term experience in an early sense of the word, meaning to test out. Yeomans called Fraser House a transitional community to convey that everything was open for testing out. Every aspect was open for change, including people, theory, processes, meta-processes, norms, policies, rules, and the like. Things that worked in context were drawn to the attention of everyone present, then repeated or adapted as appropriate to context. Those things that continued to work tended to become policy. Hence, policy was things that worked. And if policy did not continue to work, it would be adapted or discarded. As one aspect of cultural keyline, Yeomans called this process the survival of the fitting. That which fitted as process survived. Now, a Yeomans abiding metaframe and values for action was love surrounded by nurturing, humane caring, psychosocial ecology and safety. In fact, it was this aspect of psychosocial ecology that first attracted me to Neville when I met him in Balmain in 1985. He was running a group with two other people that I knew, and this was the first time I met Neville, and his attention to social ecology and safety of everyone present in the group was really outstanding. Now, Yeomans discussed his group socio-process in a monograph he wrote entitled The Problem of Taking Sides. It's in his collected archives, 1965, volume 5, in the Mitchell Library, page 46 to 47. It's the key things that I'm referring to here. Yeomans' process for working with destructive non-ecological behaviour was as follows. Whenever Yeomans was with more than one person, he was always on what he called the side of the constructive striving of everyone present, or what he called their ecological bits, defined by Yeomans as what was functional in the context, and as another aspect of cultural keyline, what he called the free energy. He took the side of or supported what he called the healthy component of a role in the relationship between individuals concerned in that unfolding context. And there's another aspect of cultural keyline, what he called the free energy. That is, what was freely available and not stuck. Work with the free energy close to the stuck energy and those sorts of concepts, which mirrored, in fact, the use of gravity to move water in land topography. When carrying out sociotherapy with family and friends within big group, Yeomans never took sides verbally or non-verbally, nor took the side of any one person. Rather, he took the side of or supported what he called the healthy component of a role in the relationship between the individuals concerned in that unfolding context. The following quotes are taken from Yeomans' monograph, The Problem of Taking Sides, when working within the intrapsychosocial structure process of any one person in the family group. Yeomans wrote that he supported certain role behaviours of a particular individual and not other role behaviours. More specifically, he supported the normal component of certain roles undertaken by the person in the particular context. Yeomans did not take sides between the two or more individuals, even though typically they may be attempting to make him do this. Yeomans was constantly supporting what he termed the positive component in role relationships, and in any one individual in the role relationship, that person's positive role behaviour component. Using this process, it was surprisingly easy for Yeomans to play very comfortably through the most potentially disturbing of family quarrels and conflicts. Within the unfolding context, Yeomans was supporting what he termed the normal component of their role relationships, and consequently the normal component of the intrapsychic role structures. Yeomans was, intrapsychosocially speaking, supporting the normal subtotal of roles in the individual and the group. At the same time, Yeomans was not supporting and condoning the abnormal role part functions of any in the group. Looked at from the perspective of a person's total personality, Yeomans was personally supporting each member of the group as a person, while fundamentally not supporting or condoning anyone's abnormal behaviour. Each member of the group was accepted. Everyone's abnormal behaviour was rejected. The tension in each individual within the family friendship subgroup was thus supported towards the normal. Another way of looking at this is that what Yeomans was actually doing in the unfolding social context was continually changing his position as a function of the particular roles that were being attempted by one or other of the partners in the exchange. What Yeomans was actually doing in the unfolding social context was continually changing his position as a function of the particular roles that were being attempted by one or other of the partners in the exchange. Yeomans was always supporting and drawing the attention of everyone present to the context-specific healthy role functions as opportunities for vicarious learning. As an example, a given behaviour such as a wife yelling at her husband may be functional in context at a particular moment and supported by Yeomans. A couple of moments later, with a change in context, the very same behaviour of yelling at the husband may be profoundly dysfunctional and interrupted by Yeomans. Ruin and Chilmaid confirmed Yeomans' use of the above behaviours in conversations I had with them in 98 and 99. Yeomans termed the functional behaviour in context the ecological bits. Yeomans, in his terms, supported the ecological bits of all concerned. He would support the functional behaviour in context and ignore the dysfunctional behaviour in context. When I was speaking with Yeomans in June 98, he called this ecology therapy. Yeomans was continually drawing the attention of all people present, including the audience, to a particular group, of the functional bits of all engaged in the unfolding flow of interaction. Hence, amongst all of the dysfunction, there was a flow of appropriate-to-the-moment behaviour that Yeomans was drawing to their attention. As well, others could often see themselves or others in the dysfunctional bits of behaviour for vicarious learning. The group was made up of very dysfunctional patients and outpatients, with some patients and outpatients being more functional after being at Fraser House for a number of weeks or because of a previous visit. Creating another transforming force, Yeomans engaged patients and outpatients in work as therapy. For example, running the canteen and winning a tender and building the unit's bowling green. This has been mentioned before in previous broadcasts, but the patients and outpatients had approached the management of the hospital and got the approval to run their own canteen that provided food and drinks between big group and small groups for all the visiting outpatients, visitors and the patients, while the staff had the review. I mentioned winning the tender and building the unit's bowling green. Again, there's a photograph of this that was in the Sydney Morning Herald of all the patients and some of the outpatients doing that work. And the bowling green area and the retaining wall is still there today, and it's survived well, though the bowling green is now a pleasant garden and the buildings are used for another purpose. Yeomans subjected everything at Fraser House to action research by both internal and external research teams. Very detailed profiling and life narratives were collected on each patient. Both the patient and outpatients were taught social research method, as mentioned before, and were co-opted as research assistants by the staff. Patients from lunatic asylums and prisons that are transferred to Fraser House were asked to think about research themes and discuss these with their peers in the unit, and then give their opinions about such things as varied as the quality of landscaping in Sydney parks and gardens and their views on the, say, intercultural issues involved in doing well in Australia's trade with Asia. See, normally these people would never be asked those things, but this is the sort of work that they were doing and saying, hey, you're valuable, you've got ideas, think about this, what do you reckon? Similarly, patients and outpatients were asked to explore and give answers to questions about their value systems. In fact, Yeomans carried out extensive values research based on the concepts of Florence Cluckholm and her writings in 1953. Yeomans Fraser House values research on patients and outpatients was followed up by questionnaires being completed by over 2,000 people in Sydney, Melbourne and Brisbane. They're the three largest cities in Australia. And Yeomans placed a survey called The Survey of Youth of Victoria in his collected papers archives in the Mitchell Library in Sydney. The next theme that we can explore is the vital aspects of Yeoman's social way of supporting change in individuals, family, friend networks, and large groups. What sorts of social dynamics, social things that were involved in this way of Fraser House? Though typically arriving with a small dysfunctional family friendship network, patients typically left the unit after 12 weeks with a functional network of between 40 and 70 people. So arrive with under 6, dysfunctional, 12 weeks, leave with a functional network of between 40 and 70. Now, many aspects of Fraser House encouraged the expansion of social networking. This was actually woven into the fabric, the very way in which everything was connected with everything was contributing to expansion of functional social networking. This is the point that really excited the anthropologist Margaret Mead when she went there. And I think it was the essence of what Maxwell Jones was saying, that the processes, the restructuring of the place made evolution inevitable. So Fraser House processes ensured these expanded and functional transformed networks were linked into other Fraser House-based networks in an extended network of networks. Now, to get a feel for this, patients arranged carpooling amongst outpatients living in their local area so that people naturally met new people from their own locality in their carpooling or travelling together. And one of the sociological categories for forming small groups was based on locality of normal domicile, providing additional scope to form acquaintances and friends from their own locality as a natural self-organising type of process. You just become friends. Linked to this concept was the concept of evolving cultural locality, meaning people connecting together, connecting to place. Patients' networks upon leaving Fraser House included members that were still remaining in the family and friend network that they had when they arrived at the unit, as well as other patients and ex-patients that they'd met through their engaging together at Fraser House. Upon first leaving, patients could return to stay at Fraser House 3 times by arrangement. Members of their growing family friendship network could also return as patients and outpatients. So these return visits were opportunities to increase functionality further and importantly to strengthen the experience base within their networks. As some of these returning patients and outpatients may be members of a number of Fraser House connected networks, with members in or returning to Fraser House, ongoing links back to the unit could be sustained for some time. Most of these networks were integrated networks, with nodal people having links into other Fraser House integrated and dispersed networks. By that I mean sometimes the networks were extremely well known to each other, with all members of it well known, and others were more loose links where a lot of the people in the network didn't know other members, but they were linked through some common one or more members, like some more of a dispersed network. Within these network of networks were nodal people. These were key linkers with links into other subsets. And the subsets of people were closely known to each other and regularly connecting in their own right. Others were linked with less frequently. They were available as resource and support people if the occasion warranted it. So that was the way in which this process generated this massive increase in naturally occurring social networking. And this meant people were engaging in sharing stories and just rumours of things that were working, were providing little moments of support and cooperation in a myriad small ways, and some of them in ways that had considerable potency, and the whole thing having potency as a result. Now, to swap theme a little bit, Yeoman's engaged in what the sociologists are calling, particularly through Burawoy, B-U-R-A-W-O-Y, particularly his 2005 writing. Yeoman's engaged in organic public sociology in opening up Fraser House process in the early 60s to public scrutiny and engagement across a wide number of people. So this was part of the socio process as well, the sociotherapy process. Fraser House Big Group gained a reputation as one of the best places to learn about group process, and there was a continual stream of visitors to big and small groups, including academics and students from various disciplines, including clinical sociology, socio-medicine, community psychiatry, clinical psychology, social psychology, even criminology and the partial work of the clergy, social workers. Patients and outpatients gained further life experience and been involved in training people from all of these areas. Chilmaid and Bruin both commented on the way in which these people, as visitors to Big Group, would get training from the patients and outpatients. In this engagement, as with all Fraser House engagement, Yeomans was evolving a role of public sociologist as enabler, or you could say supporting others to be more able in improving wellness in all aspects of their life together. Other people who attended Big Groups were church leaders, politicians, business leaders, even public servants, even senior people, say from one classic example was from the Federal Department of Foreign Affairs. This was arranged by Ian Russell, a senior member of the Department of Foreign Affairs who had grown up with his mother, Dr. J. Russell, on the grounds of the 1,800-bed Kenmore Hospital in Goulburn, south of Sydney. That was where Dr. Russell and her associate had Yeoman's assistance in setting up a 300-bed therapeutic community modelled upon Fraser House. And Yeoman's work with Dr. Mitchell was the colleague, and Dr. Russell at Kenmore was featured in a newspaper article on the 19th of June in 1963 in a local paper, Kenmore's Group Therapy Plan. That was in the Evening Post of 1963. Dr. Mitchell in that paper is quoted as saying, "A large-scale community living or group therapy used at Kenmore since last year has proved an unparalleled success." All of this patient and outpatient experience that was growing up within Fraser House had important implications for Fraser House effectiveness. One is that after Fraser House had evolved during the first year, the big groups began to be comprised of a substantial and influential number of patients and outpatients who had gained considerable talent, who had become experienced sociotherapists in their own right during their stays. These people all had experience in working at the edge in big and small groups. This group of very experienced people were able to support Yeomans and other staff in sociotherapy practice, and this increased the capability of the whole group as crowd and audience to stay at threshold, what Turner has called liminal space in his 1977 writing. Liminal is at the threshold, or the old English word for the doorstep, limen. It's in the word preliminary. There was a critical catalytic mass of socially and relationally talented people among staff, patients and outpatients continually passing through the system and ready, willing and available to act as resource people and as change agents. So that's very important to recognise. It wasn't that these people were helpless and hopeless, even though they were arriving with considerable dysfunction. In a very short time, they had this highly evolved skills and were contributing in quite strategic ways. All involved in Fraser House were together exploring the concept, the phenomena and the experience of socialisation in action, sociotherapy. They were exploring socialising within families, family friendship networks and within community. They were doing this during big and small groups, as audience member and as member of a crowd, as well as during everyday life in the Fraser House milieu. They were exploring what things, actions, normative processes, moods, individual, family and group, thematic, folky, and other aspects contributed to or detracted from socialising process. They were doing this over time and as context shifted from moment to moment. They were attending to the interplay between the individual and shared experience in reconstituting individual and shared reality and realities. Socialising in action was something that was noticed and brought to people's notice. The above exploring of socialising unfolding was supported and enabled. People were supported to be able to do this well. Together they explored what worked in creating a good life where people felt well and felt well in sharing time with each other, and where they evolved their own norms, law, as in way of life, and governing together, and realised and shared wisdom together. Social ecology was an integral aspect of the process. Throughout this talk, I've been listing many, many aspects, sort of making a long list of this is what made it work, and that made it work, and that made it work, and one could be concluding, well, you know, what else was in there? You know, if I missed something out in all of this listing of things, I'm a little bit like the salesman that says, wait, there's more, and wait, there's more. There's an important sense, I think, that the Margaret Mead comment and the Maxwell Jones comment comes to the very heart and essence of what made it work. And recall that Margaret Mead said it was the most total therapeutic community. And by that, I sense that she wasn't meaning like a total institution that Goffman wrote about, but the way in which everything, absolutely everything, was woven together to contribute to change to well-being. And I think Maxwell Jones was getting at the same thing. It was a structure and process where evolution towards well-being and functionality was inevitable. It was just evolution. And the essence of that, which is woven through all these things I've been mentioning, is that the way in which the inter, and you can put after INT many words that gets this denseness of it all, things were all interconnected, and simultaneously they were interrelated, which is different to interconnected, and there was all sorts of interdependencies and interdepending going on. And there are all sorts of interactions, and there are all sorts of interweaving of all of that together. And we don't really have an English word that gets and includes all of that very well. So I'm using an old English word, connexity, that Neville was enriching the connexity entails all of those words, inter words that I mentioned before. And also, this is what Neville and his father and his two brothers had done on the farm, where they were having a very particular form of perception and focused attending to complex living systems on the farm, so that they begin to see and notice and make sense of and be able to make use of the interdependencies. And they could create ways that enriched the interconnecting and interdependencies and interrelatedness and interaction. And this, I think, was what, even when I was talking to all of the people that were connected with Fraser House, every one of them said, we don't know how it worked. It was just bewildering. We couldn't make sense of it, but we were immersed in it. And Neville himself said, go back to my father's work. And I think that's what he meant. To understand, you have to get a sense of what I'm now calling connectivity. It wasn't a word that Neville used. Now to go to a concluding theme. There was lots of things that were happening in Fraser House that today you would say, my God, how could we ever get that past red tape? See, Fraser House involvement of patients and outpatients as change agents raises by implication the whole issue of risk and how it can be addressed and how it was addressed back in Fraser House. Now, in my background, there has been a studies and work practice that I've done in the area of risk and risk management, to be with actuarial studies under my belt, and
I've headed up an actuarial department, so I have some understanding of these mathematical and probabilistic approaches to risk and risk minimisation. Any consideration of applying Fraser House practice today would have to consider risk, where a prevailing view in mental health, certainly in Australia, posits risk in probabilistic and actuarial terms as something that has to be managed, implying that risk can be contained by applying appropriate knowledge and implementing of strategic and anticipatory measures and control of behaviour. Right here in Australia, Adams Clarkson has written about that in 2008. Now, she makes the point that people don't necessarily react to risks in predictable, logical or rational ways, all the more so with the people at Neville Haddon and Fraser House, the mad and the bad, said in the past in colloquial terms. In Fraser House, the minimising and governance of risk was not by some administrative decree, but the minimising and governance of risk was woven absolutely into praxis. This is an important point. Firstly, everything with a capital E was framed within social ecology and human caring values. Secondly, socialising processes and forces were used to sustain the functional in the midst of the dysfunctional. Remember the earlier parts of the talk here, where Neville would be constantly drawing their attention to the functional aspects of behaviours in context. Remember that. So socialising processes, to repeat, and pauses were used to sustain the functional in the midst of the dysfunctional. And thirdly, staff, patients and outpatients alike were engaged in mutual self-governance through a comprehensive system of committees. Every single aspect of the unit supported people transforming to a functional life and creating a safe place for that to happen. Social ecology, if you like, was very high on everyone's thinking from shortly after their arrival and those visits they had before they even were accepted. So a rich array of interrelated and interconnected and interdependent social processes were evolved and interacted together. Some of these have been outlined above. And one protocol was that immediately a risk context was developing or where the likelihood of risk escalation was evident, an immediate call would go out to as many as possible of the staff and resident population to gather together at the context. An experienced crowd guided by caring values would very quickly form, interrupt, intervene and resolve issues consistent with that slogan that they used, "No madness or badness here, thank you." As discussed, after the unit had been operating for a time, there are always many skilled people among the staff, patients and outpatients available as resource people. People were skilled in group and crowd process and in domiciliary care. They had groups all going out providing assistance to people who had already left. Those that hadn't left and were already helping those who had left. So they were highly skilled in intervening in some potential risk context. Another protocol was that no one was to engage in unilateral action, even staff. The slogan, "Bring it up in the group," meant creating a group immediately if the situation warranted it. So, as recognised by Margaret Mead, it was the density and totality of all of the many aspects of the unit acting together in interrelated and interdependent ways that was so potent in the Fraser House process. There was a sustained social impulse, maintaining social forces, creating and sustaining momentum for transition towards wellness. As one example from the induction process onwards, almost all patients and outpatients involved in Fraser House came to have a strongly held commitment to contribute to its success and reputation. This commitment was an integral aspect of the fast response to interrupt anything that would jeopardise its continued integrity, ecology, safety, nurturing and very existence. Another particular risk aspect was the risk of suicide, and any at-risk and potential suiciders were never left alone. A small group of patients and staff were selected to be constantly around them as a support and crisis intervention group. Patients would be co-opted as therapeutic enablers, and patients could and did take on the role of being caring support for other patients, especially those in danger of self-harm. Any person who is in a heightened emotional state, disturbed or suicidal, would be immediately specialed. This term was used where processes were set up such that a cooperating team of patients with or without staff would take on the responsibility of providing 24-hour support to other patients at risk or suicidal. And in the process, this support team would gain responsibility, the ability to respond well. This meant that two or more experienced patients or an experienced patient or patients and staff member or members would continually stay awake with that person at risk around the clock and be replaced by another shift if necessary until, on the say of the group, the specialed status was removed. This idea of support processes for suicidals was subsequently used elsewhere in the world and has since become a standard practice in mental health services in Australia to some degree. Given the information that I've been talking about and the, I sense, rich potential of all of these ideas, perhaps the time is now ready for some people to take up this social impulse from the 50s and 60s to really pick up this whole notion of how do you do sociotherapy and using socialisation processes. Some of the extraordinary rich praxis evolved by Neville Yeomans and others at Fraser House has been outlined in this talk. There are other articles on Radio 2C International about Fraser House, about 10 of them, and some others that discuss some of the outreach from Fraser House. The clinical and organic public sociology practice contained in this discussion that we've been having has potential to be adapted to therapeutic community practice and many other issues facing 21st century society, including support for self-help among people who become isolates following war, through work accidents, traffic accidents, through loss of family, friends and networks for any reason. Even as I'm talking, Victoria in Australia is in the midst of cyclonic firestorms, and already the media is starting to draw attention to the strength of community. And while there is all this talk about getting services to them and teeing up various authorities for the reconstruction, underneath, behind the scenes and almost flying under the radar, there is all this naturally occurring mutual support processes. Last Saturday, I went along to a gathering of about, it wasn't even a gathering, it was just the word got out that people were coming together in a delightful spot on the fringe of the fire zone. And 100 people came in sharing of simple stories and just hugs and smiles. And they had some quiet meditation at one stage, some playing of the appropriate violin and guitar music that was gentle and appropriate unto the mood, people hearing in small groups extraordinary stories of heroism, and again this naturally self-organising processes of using community for healing. So given the wide concern about sustainable futures more generally, it may be useful for the ideas that have been expressed in this talk to be copied and passed on to others. So there may be the applying of this more widely in the community. Thank you. This has been Les Spencer in Melbourne, Victoria, signing off.